Welcome once again to another week at the Religious Studies Project. I'm one of your hosts, David Robertson.
And I'm the other one of your hosts, Christopher Cotter.
This week, I'm pleased to bring you an interview with Erica Baffelli. And this is another interview recorded by Paulina Calata. The subject this week is religious authority, and particularly religious authority in Asia, focusing on Erica's work in mostly in Japan and new religious movements. I'm just going to pass over to Paulina.
Please do.
Welcome to the Religious Studies Project. My name is Paulina Calata, and this is an interview with Dr. Erica Baffelli. Hello, Erica.
Hi.
Erica is from the University of Manchester, and we will be talking today about the notion of religious authority in Japan, especially in the context of the new religious movements. Erica Baffelli is a senior lecturer in the Department of East Asian Studies here at Manchester. Erica's research focuses on religion in contemporary Japan, with a special focus on new religions, Shinshukyo and Shinshinshukyo, religion and the media, and the religion and the internet. But today we will focus on the notion of authority and charismatic leadership in the context of new religious movements in Japan today. But before we touch upon the charisma itself, shall we just take a step back? And I would like to mention the workshop that took place in October last year that you have kindly invited me to observe. And this workshop focused on the notion of religious authority in Asia in more general terms. It kind of revealed, well, what was revealed during the workshop is that the understanding of the notion of authority itself can be read in a number of different ways. And I was just wondering, what would be your reading of religious authority in the context of Japan specifically?
Okay, so as you mentioned, that workshop in October was the first part of a new research project which aimed to look at the religious authority in Asia and the problem of strategies and of recognition. And it's a project founded by the British Inter-University China Center and the White Rose East Asian Center. And one of the thing that came out quite clearly in the discussion that followed the workshop was that to understand authority, a religious authority in the context of Japan or East Asia, we need to look at different layers of authorities. We need to have different angles. And one of them, just to mention a few of the central ones that I think are important to look at Japan too, is one, the state and the politics, which might not look that central now in Japan as they look in China, for example, but they are still present and they are probably becoming more present recently in the Japanese context too. The other layer that we thought was quite interesting was that the idea of traditional authorities and agency. So the leader, the board of elders, the patrons, and how they interact with each other, and who owns the leader, who is the leader responding to in this different religious organization. The other was the official and unofficial authority, the presence of self-appointed authorities, especially in a context like Japan, where you have different religious traditions that don't have sometimes a clear central authority or a defined central authority or dogmatic authority. And then, of course, this is linked with the idea of moral or charismatic authority that appear from that too. And the other very interesting layer that came out was the ambivalence of authority. So there are different modes and how authority is challenged and how authority is rediscussed in a contemporary secular society as Japan is and how religious authority is seen in the larger context. The other interesting aspect is the idea of space or where the authority is enacted. So temples, village, mountain, environment, all these different Well, the different spaces are also very, very important.
But there was also a cyberspace, I guess, and the connection with the
exactly
and online then, presence.
Then not physical space of the media or the internet, which is one of the aspects I've been more interested in, and how these also are impacting and localizing authority in a contemporary society. And finally, of course, I'm forgetting one of the important layers, which is the text, which, of course, works in a different way in a Shinto or Buddhist context that it does in a Christian context, for example. But the authority of some texts are still very relevant in some of Japanese religious tradition, too. And the other layer I'm quite forgetting that is quite important too is the human and non-human religious authority, where the authority is located and embodied. So the role of the body of the leader or the deities, etc. It was one of the other aspects that came out quite clearly. So I think there are different ways of reading religious authority in Japan, and all of them are significant. So we need to look at all this layer and how they work with, interact with their mother to understand if religious authority is still relevant and how it's relevant in a more secular society.
But would you then argue that there is anything particularly distinctive about the religious authority as compared to, let's say, Christian religious authority in the Western societies, where the religious authority can be stemming out from itself, or whereas religious authority is just an element of the authority itself. So whether there is anything distinctive in relation to the Japanese cultural context, and especially also when we look at the new religious movements.
Well, there is surely historical element and historical developments that make religious authority in Japan in a certain way. And of course, these historical traces need to be looked at to understand how Buddhist religious authority work in Japan, or the issues of authority in Shinto. But at the same time, there are elements, I think, that goes beyond Japan and has more to do with the impact of modernization on society, or globalization more in contemporary society, that can be looked at in Japan, but also in different contexts. So it's one of the reasons we really wanted to do in this work, just as to have a comparative perspective too, to look and especially look at an East Asian country and how similar issues are dealt in different way, and especially in Korea, China, Japan, because they are related to different cultural and historical contexts, but there are also similarities between them. So the issue of politics and the state, again, to rename one I already mentioned. With new religious movement, I think that, which is also a context and term itself, it's still quite useful to define a certain type of religious organization. But again, there are, in the Japanese context, I think there are specificity to each of these groups of how religious authority has been constructed and then negotiated with the member. But at the same time, you can see similarities in how religious leadership, charismatic leadership in this case, has been negotiated and discussed and challenged in the Japanese case and in other cases and in other contexts like Europe or North America, Taiwan, etc., and the relationship between the religious authority and the member of these groups.
Okay. Well, one of the interesting layers that you mention is the notion of charisma and also the notion of the leadership itself. For instance, Dr. Hiroko Kawanami's research on Myanmar suggests that the notion of charismatic leadership appears to play a very crucial part in the construction of religious authority itself within the social context. What role do leaders and their charisma play within the new religious movements in Japan, in your opinion? And how does this shape the relationship between the members and the leaders in the group context?
The group we are talking about, they are usually called in Japanese Shinshuki or New Religion, are mainly groups that started to be founded from the late 19th century and 20th century. And the idea of the charismatic leader has always been seen as one of the defined characteristics of those groups. So most of them were founded around a leader that was proposing a new vision, an alternative vision, a new path. And people were starting gathering around this leader, etc. There is also some other characteristic in the traditional definition of charismatic authority goes back to Weber that apply to most of this case, especially in the very early stage of formation. The idea of this leadership or this authority being unstable, that can deteriorate. So the need for this leader to keep proving to their member that they have authority. So the idea also of several changes and quick changes in the group to maintain authority. So this idea that charismatic authority is fluid and need to be tweaked and changed with the changing situation. At the same time, though, I also think that the charismatic authority is an important aspect, but the definition needs to be expanded a little bit more in a more contemporary context. For example, Nancy Stalker, in her study on Omoto, talk about entrepreneurial character of charismatic leadership and the Deguchi Onesaburo in Omoto. And the importance of this aspect too, the member being able, the leader being able also to be an entrepreneur. So this idea of this engaged leader doesn't work any longer in a more competitive religious marketplace. Another interesting recent studies was Clara Chinson's article on Soka Gakkai leader Ikeda Daisaku. And Clark Chilson talk about the importance of identification with the leader, with the members and the leader, and how the leader's diary has been extremely important in creating this identification between them. Another aspect that I think is quite interesting is the idea of not putting any longer authority, charismatic authority and institution as opposed to each other, but the idea that the institution can be actually important to support and reinforce the charismatic authority. And I think has been the case in several groups in Japan. So no more the charismatic authority and routinization as one process after the other, but actually as two processes going together and reinforcing the image and the leader, and especially trying to support the leader and this instability characteristic of the charismatic authority. And one of the scholars that look at it is Julia Huang. They look at a Taiwan group-based group Tsuchi and talk about the combination between the leader personal appeal, but also the organization technique used by the group as a combination. And I think this is also another important aspect to go beyond the charisma. Further, I think in later stage of development of those groups, although the leader is still very important, other elements became very important too. So the role of the board of the elderly, for example, or the board, the elderly, the long-term membership role too, and how this little, that the, how the authority might became diffused between different type of authority figure inside of the group. So it's not just the leader at the top, but there are all other head of the centers or head of some of the group that became quite relevant in the development of the group. And finally, as Isaac Gagne look at his study of Japanese contemporary movement, what's happened after the death of the leader? So the post-charismatic a stage has been quite important for several of these groups. And it's quite interesting to see how some of them are actually try to walk away from the idea of charismatic mm-hmm. leader, because those figure are not always easy manageable, and also go away from this very large in life persona to a more manageable leader image, where the charisma is not necessarily the most important feature. So I think that definitely charismatic authority was important for some of this group at the beginning, but we need to look at a broader definition of charismatic authority to understand the dynamics and how this group developed and survive for a long time.
So it almost sounds like diffusing of the authority itself to familiarize or to narrow the gap between the leader and the member as well. Mm. And as far as I'm aware, in terms of the new religious movements, in order to kind of connect closer with the membership and kind of create a closer relationship between leadership and membership in the new religious movements in Japan, the role of media has been quite significant in terms of trying to bring the connectivity throughout Japan and obviously the access to the leader itself. So my question is, what role do the media play, in your opinion, in the process of asserting the levels of authority or asserting the levels of leadership at the same time? It's within the religious group, but also at the same time, kind of establishing the relationship between the insider and the outsider areas of influence.
Yeah, it's you already pointed out the two important aspects when we look at media and media authority, because it's another layer, is that media can be at the same time used to reinforce the leader authority and to support the leader authority or reshape the image of the group. But at the same time, media themselves can use their own authority to delegitimize a group or to criticize and actually to shape our image of a particular religion organization. And this has been very clear in the entire history of the relationship between media and Japanese new religion organization, because you can see both of these dynamics working. From one side, the media has been very important for some of this group to become visible, because visibility is extremely important for them, more than for more traditional religion organization, if you can use the term, because they don't have this long history of presence, so visibility is extremely important, and media outlets have given them a platform where to be visible. Media has been used for some of this group, like Ofuku no Kagaku or Agonshu in particular, to create the image of a very wealthy group and a very strong and powerful leader. And in the case of Kofuku no Kagaku, I think media has also been used to protect the image of the leader from criticism, especially in the 90s. More recently, media, especially the internet, has been used by very newly formed religion organization like Hikari no Wa to reshape completely the idea of the leader. So Joyu Fumihiro, a former member of Aum Shinrikyo and spokesperson of the group that committed the Saringast attack in 1995, through his blog has been trying to create a new connection with the members. So the idea of a leader that is approachable, you can talk to, you can connect through the internet. But at the same time, media has been attacking new religion and from the very beginning, from early 20th century attack on Tenrikyo no Motokyo, that the famous case of Renmokyo that was strongly attacked by the media, that controversies between Yomiuri Shimbun and Rishoko Seikai later on, or in the 90s between Kofuku no Kagaku and Kodansha publisher, a raw expression of media becoming the watchdog of society and decided with their authority what are the good religion and what are the bad religion. And of course, the case of Aum Shinrikyo in the late 90s is the more exemplary of how the media reacted to the sarin gas attack. Although before that, the leader of Aum was often invited in TV show, and there was a strong presence in the media because this charismatic personality also creates audience. So at the same time, the media are attracted to them. But as soon as the attack happened, of course, the media became very careful on defining who can be the next Aum and what are the dangerous group. So you have this very complex and ambivalent relationship between the two spheres that sometimes overlap. So it's quite difficult sometimes to see the difference between the two. And of course, the main difference also between internal media, the media that are used and produced by the religion organization. And one of the interesting one is, for example, the use of self-narrative and conversion stories in magazine and books of the group that are used to internalize a specific idea of the group and the leader. And at the other side, you have the external media, so the television, the newspaper, or the internet, which are in a different relationship with the religion organization. At the end, economics came play a role as well, of course, because media are economic enterprises, and of course advertising revenue, etc., has also played a role on how this group talk or especially decide not to talk about religious topics in Japan.
Okay. So considering the kind of different areas of within which the religious groups, the new religious groups in Japan are trying to reassert the authority. In the context of Japanese society today, considering the dwindling numbers of membership, actually, the new members joining the new religious movements, such as Soka Gakkai, Agonshu, or Tenrikyo, how are these movements doing in Japan today, in the society which is more increasingly kind of divorcing itself from the idea of religious affiliation? And despite obviously the efforts of reinforcing or nurturing the religious authority within its groups or trying to impact on a greater society, how are they actually doing?
It's always very difficult to find exact number of membership of this group because the official numbers are usually not published, or even in the yearbook of religion that is published every year by the Ministry of Education, the numbers of membership there are submitted by the religious institution themselves. So they should be, so that they might be a bit problematic. But it seems quite general, this impression that the group membership is decreasing or quite stagnant. And I think that for some of this group, they are going, especially two of the three you mentioned, Agonshu and Soka Gakkai, they are in a very interesting stage of their development. So because their leader is aging, and so they are is in a phase where the group is deciding what they're going to be. To be next. And quite interesting, both group apparently has decided not to have a successor. So it seems that both group are deciding to go away from the charismatic phases and go in a post-charismatic, which we will see what's happened when this will actually happen. But apparently, and both group has announced that they won't be a successor for the leader. The other struggle I think other groups are facing and at the moment and came up in some of the interview I've done with some of this group is they seem they've been losing a bit their peculiarity. So what made them attractive in especially group that became quite large in the 80s? They became large and attracted a significant membership because of something particular in their doctrine, in their vision, and they're trying to regain it, but it's not that easy, especially because, as you mentioned, in Japan is more and more a secular, very secular society, but also because the image of religion is still quite negative, and there's still the effect of post-sarin gas attack situation. And even though the Japanese new religion was seen negatively even before 1995, the sarin gas attack and the image of Aum actually made the situation worse. And for a lot of people, and then the group are aware of that, that they are associated with the idea of cult. It's a very negative idea. And they still try to come to terms with it and try to prove that they are not dangerous or what they are doing is actually significant for the society. Some of them are more engaged in welfare activities or relief activity, not just in Japan, but overseas as well. And some has been trying to go overseas, especially in Southeast Asia countries. But I think that most of them are facing a kind of identity crisis at the moment or trying to attract new young members seems to be one of the main problems, and not just maintaining the long-term membership, but actually have new blood entering the group seems to be one of the big challenges they are facing together with aging membership and aging leadership and what will happen after some of this leader will not be with us anymore.
I suppose we do have to wait for that.
Yeah.
To observe that. Not a
really jolly conclusion.
Not very much. But I think on that note, this is where we will end it today. Thank you very much, Erica.
Thank you.
It's been a pleasure.
So another excellent interview there from Paola, and I know that we are going to be hearing from her in the not-too-distant future as well. There are a few interviews on the cards that have not yet happened.
Yeah, and great to hear a new voice on the interviewing, a part of our expanded interviewers team for this year.
Absolutely. And the notion of authority has come up in previous podcasts, of course. I'm thinking back to my interview with Pauline Hope Chung on religious authority and social media.
Indeed.
Indeed. It's useful to have that flagged up.
And we're going to be returning to the subject of authority next week.
Are we?
We are, in my interview with Carol Cusack and Steve Sutcliffe, talking about G.I. Gurdjieff. And rather than a historical overview, we focus particularly on his role as a guru and how religious authority was constructed, both in his lifetime and by his followers in the years since, and how that legacy has been controlled and its relationship actually with our studying of it.
Wonderful. And the attentive listener will have noticed that we actually had a quite extended discussion about Gurdjieff last week at the end of the podcast, because we'd initially thought that we would run with that interview this week. But if you've listened to both podcasts, you'll have seen that the contextualization of Gurdjieff is quite different in both cases, given the fact that this week we've been talking about authority. So
indeed. But that's the nature of doing a weekly publication of any type.
Absolutely.
Sometimes schedules change.
Yeah. I don't really have too much more to tell you, folks. There's a lot of interesting developments in the pipeline in terms of what interviews we will be bringing you. There's no conferences really happening at the moment that we've got a presence at, though if you would like us to have a presence at your conference and it's happening soon, just let us know. The response this week will be from Avery Morrow. Kevin's continuing to do a fine job of bringing you responses, and we look forward to reading that. The only things really to say are to shout out, as ever, to the British Association for the Study of Religions for their continued and ever gratefully received support. To you, the listeners, to all of you who have used our amazon.co.uk.com and .ca links to support us, it really does help. And, you know, pay Venetia back for all her hard work on the social media by following our social media feeds and telling your friends. And there's been a lot of interesting stuff. There's something about chocolate deities yesterday, which I particularly enjoyed.
You enjoyed the chocolate deities or the subject of them?
Both.
But, she's feeling neglected that she's not getting enough likes. So click away if you've enjoyed her posts. But other than that, thanks for listening.